Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Writer Scott Russell Sanders is loved by many for novels and essays, many of which carry a natural theme. But while the environment does play a significant, vital role in his books, such as A Conservationist Manifesto and his latest, Divine Animal, it's not the only issue he writes about. Sanders' work spans 20 books of fiction and nonfiction, though, as we'll hear, nonfiction isn't a term he especially likes. He's told his own coming-of-age story, he's examined how geography influences culture, and is currently at work on a project exploring the meaning of wealth. Along the way, he's collected numerous awards for his writing and also appointments such as the 2014 Lois and Willard Mackey Distinguished Professor of Creative Writing at Beloit College, which comes to an end today. It is the second time he's held that post. He spoke earlier this week at Milwaukee's Urban Ecology Center, and he joined us in the studio. Welcome. It's a pleasure to meet you.
I'm happy to be here.
There's a temptation to talk chronologically with you about your work, but I was hoping actually we might start with the present day. You have spent the last couple of months at Beloit as the Lois Mackey Chair in Creative Writing. If a student of yours, you know, whether or not it's in the formal classroom setting, gets no other message from working with you, what do you hope they take?
I think the single most important lesson I've learned from a life in writing is that writing is a way of thinking and writing is a way of discovery. Often in school, as we're growing up, writing is presented to us as a way of packaging knowledge that's already known and then delivering it in a nice, neat fashion to the teacher. You're not really making any discoveries. But the kind of writing I enjoy reading and the kind of writing I encourage my students to do is writing where you're actually discovering things about your experience, about the world, about language, about reality. And so that's the single most important lesson or insight that I would hope they would go away with.
Do you find it's difficult to turn off that need to know exactly where you're going with something and what you're going to reveal, you know, before you set out on the writing journey?
It took me quite a while. And I understand that students might feel very insecure if they're launching out on an inquiry and really don't know where it's going to end up. Obviously, they always have a chance to revise. So once you've ended up somewhere, you can then revise the whole piece to prepare for where you've landed. But it requires an openness to insight, an openness to exploration that we tend not to be taught when we're coming up through school. Again, we tend to be taught in a way where you're finding the certain things, the known things, and you're simply delivering them rather than discovering them.
It's interesting. There is a phenomenon in radio programs like this called the pre-interview that many shows follow, where there's a producer who will call an interview subject and essentially interview that person before the host interviews that person, so that there are no surprises once the interview actually takes place.
There is a major American hotel chain, I won't name the brand, which for some years ran a television advertisement in which a couple traveling, first of all, they come into a lobby where they're strange. People are dressed in strange clothes and strange sounds and creatures, and they decide to leave. And then they go to this chain hotel, and the clerk welcomes them, and the ad says, no surprises. In other words, this is a place where you know everything before you come. But of course, we don't learn anything if we know everything before we start. We only learn by being open to new discoveries. I've actually had those pre-interview interviews, and so I know what you're talking about. And I always find the actual interview much less interesting if it feels more canned than one where I and the interviewer are really exploring together.
There's this whole field that, you know, maybe I missed it when I was in school, but it seems like maybe the label is a recent development, the idea of so-called creative nonfiction. What are your feelings about that label?
I dislike the label intensely, and you would not have encountered it when you were in school because it's a relatively new term. It has two problems with it. The first is the word creative, and the second word is the word nonfiction. The problem with the word creative is it implies that there are other kinds of writing and other kinds of thought, for that matter, that are not creative. Well, I happen to love science, and my my wife's a scientist, my daughter's a scientist, and my undergraduate studies were in science. And science is tremendously creative. Good history requires creative intelligence. A good biography does as well. So I don't distinguish between creative writing and writing that's somehow not creative. So that's the first problem. The bigger problem, however, is nonfiction. That's a term that was coined in the 19th century by librarians to divide their collection between novels and stories on the one hand, and on the other hand, sermons and histories and very serious books. Well, calling all those kinds of writing nonfiction is like saying food is divided up between cheese and non-cheese, right? Well, that doesn't help you very much. So that spaghetti is non-cheese and so is pork and so is chocolate. And they're all non-cheese, but that doesn't really tell you anything interesting. So I think the term creative nonfiction is an unfortunate one. I also feel we're stuck with it. So my workshop is in the writing. I have two different ways of describing it. One is personal essays and one is personal narratives. And the personal is an important word. It's to distinguish it from scholarship and journalism. And narrative means storytelling. But these are this is storytelling where the stories you're telling derive directly from your own experience. You're not making them up, in other words.
Do you think – are we too quick to put things that seem objectively scientific in that box? I guess the question I'm working towards is you said you yourself studied science at first in school. Your wife is a scientist. Your daughter is a scientist. Are we too quick to remove the creativity from science and separate things like science and math from the humanities?
Oh, definitely. My wife, when she would come home from the lab and I would ask her how the experiment was going, she'd say, well, we're getting wonderful data, but we don't have a story yet. And this wasn't unique to her. This is a term that scientists frequently use. And by story, she means, okay, we have these pieces of evidence that we've gathered from our experiment. But the story essentially is the narrative which connects them. And that's what a scientific hypothesis is. And that requires creativity. All of the great scientists have testified to this. Einstein and Galileo and Newton and so forth have talked about the role that imagination plays in science. It's not just a machine where you turn the crank enough times and then out comes some scientific theory. You gather evidence, but then you have to see a pattern, and that requires imagination. So I see good science as being absolutely as creative an endeavor as composing music or painting paintings or writing poetry.
How did you discover the personal essay?
I discovered it as a confirmed fiction writer. All of my early writing for about 15 years was short stories and novels, and I still write fiction. My most recent book is a novel. But when I became a father and spent lots of time with our two young children, I wanted to write about those experiences I was having with them, but I didn't want to fictionalize them. And so I started writing what I thought of simply as true stories. This is something I did yesterday with my son. This is something I did today with my daughter. And those true stories, it turned out, were essays. And I didn't even know they were essays until magazines started publishing them and calling them essays. And I came to write more and more of that personal essay kind of writing as a way of exploring my own experience.
Why didn't you want to fictionalize them?
Well, there are two reasons that I didn't want to fictionalize my experiences with my children, with young children. First of all, it's very difficult to treat children in fiction without sentimentalizing them. And second of all, it would seem to distort or take away from the actual veracity of the experience that I have with my children and now with my grandchildren. So I think there are experiences that lend themselves to fictionalizing, where free invention makes sense. And then there are experiences where you have a respect for the actual experience and you don't want to alter it in the way that fiction would require. So as I say, today I write both. I write fiction and I write essays. And I almost always know at the outset clearly and distinctly which kind of thing I'm writing.
Many of your essays and much of your fiction has an environmental feel to it. Did you consider yourself an environmental writer when you first began writing?
I didn't, no. But I grew up in the country in Ohio, rural Ohio, spent as much time as I could outdoors. And so I've always loved nature. I thought of it as nature. I always loved trees and creeks and rocks and so forth. And so my writing has always been filled with references to the natural world. And it wasn't until I was in my 30s, really. I'm now 68, so it's been a while. But it wasn't until I was in my 30s that I began to see that nature, what we call nature, is endangered. The things that I love, the things that I find beautiful and exciting and that have nourished me all my life are endangered. And because nature's endangered, we're endangered. So that meant in the jargon of our culture that I'm an environmentalist. So I didn't set out to become an environmentalist. It was a way – it was a consequence of following my fascination with and love of the natural world. What I call myself now, people say, are you a nature writer? And I say, actually, I'm an earth writer. That is, I'm aware of living on a planet alongside about 7 billion of my own species and millions of other species. And depending for everything that I eat and drink and wear and use in my daily life, as do we all, on the earth. So I'm intensely aware of belonging to the natural world.
It seems as though you were coming into your own in this career at a time when maybe the conservation movement was also coming into its own, the Clean Water and the Clean Air Acts, and not long before the first Earth Day. How did the place of the movement in the public eye perhaps affect the writer you were becoming?
Oh, it had a very big effect. I was deeply influenced by several major social movements in the 1960s, because that's when I came of age. I graduated from high school in 1963. I graduated from college in 1967. I finished a PhD in English in 1971. So basically the decade of the 1960s was the decade in which I formed most of my adult concerns and many of my values. And the nascent environmental movement of the 1960s was a major part of that. So was the civil rights movement. So was the women's movement. So was the anti-war movement. So those were the big social public movements that were convulsing our culture in the 1960s and that had a profound influence on me. Listeners today may find it, especially younger listeners, may find it hard to believe that in the 1960s, there was bipartisan support for the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, Endangered Species Act, the Wilderness Act, the Environmental Protection Agency Act. There was a sense that we need to take care of our shared world, the natural world on which we depend. Unfortunately, that consensus has been lost in most of our state legislatures and definitely in the U.S. Congress.
Scott Russell Sanders, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
It's been a pleasure, Mitch. Thanks for having me on.
Scott Russell Sanders just finished a term as the Mackey Distinguished Professor of Creative Writing at Beloit College. He taught from 1971 to 2009 at Indiana University, where he is now a Distinguished Professor Emeritus of English. His latest novel is Divine Animal. It's currently available for free as an ebook. There is a link from wuwm.com/likeeffect. Why are some young Wisconsinites choosing to pursue a career in farming? We'll hear from one farmer when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.